The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavor swirling together with cold brew, topped with a velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles, and that imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. Participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.
Hey, welcome to this week's episode of Zach on Film. Joining me again this week is Matthew Peterson.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, Matthew. And of course, the ever wonderful Steven Schleicher.
Hello.
Hey, Steven. So we're continuing to go into the movies this July, and we're jumping back into the 80s this time with their second film, Raising Arizona. Starring everyone's favorite, Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, Nicolas Cage. And Holly Hunter. Don't forget Holly Hunter.
Yeah, of course, Holly Hunter.
And of course, a longtime favorite actor that we see in Coen Brothers films, John Goodman.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if William Forsythe has appeared in a lot of other Coen movies. I want to say yes, but maybe not. Frances McDormand pops in there really quick, as does Emmett Walsh pops in too. So,
yep.
A lot of names in here.
Forsythe was in Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead. Is that a Coen Brothers movie?
No.
I don't think so.
Okay. Because he's one of those guys who's in everything from about 1985 to 1995 and then sort of disappears.
Yeah, it is crazy thinking about that this was 1987 instead of the second film and how they've already established, like, these are the people we're going to work with for the next two decades.
Steven and I were 16 years old.
Yeah, in March of 87, yes.
So you were old enough to see this movie in theaters because it's only PG-13.
No, we talked about it a lot. My friend Jeff and I talked a lot about it because he had seen it in the theater. And I don't know, he would have graduated. He was a year ahead of me. So by the time it would have come out on VHS, he would have been a long way to college. So I'd heard a lot about it, had not seen it until, I don't know, probably junior year in college, maybe. So maybe that's 4 years after the movie came out.
Okay.
That's about the same time for me. I didn't see this movie until a girl that I was completely in love with, who later on married my roommate, decided she wanted to see it and said it was the funniest thing ever. So I saw it on VHS in maybe 1990, 91, 92. It was in that same area. So
okay. So Raising Arizona, starring Nicolas Cage, is a film about a convict who continually robs convenience stores with an unloaded gun.
Right.
And through his process of being booked repeatedly, falls in love with Ed, who is the lady in charge of taking everyone's photo as they enter prison.
And Officer Edwina Hookett.
As he continues to be booked, I don't know, four or five times in the kind of prologue of this movie, we get a love sequence that is rooted in prison. And eventually when High, who is Nicolas Cage's character, or H.I., they call him High, is released for the fourth time that we see, he walks right into the photo-taking room and says, Ed, I'm going to get down on my knee and marry you. And then they get married, and they start a happy life together until it's not so happy anymore, Steven.
Yeah, it turns out that Ed can't have children. Mm-hmm. And so that causes a lot of stress in the marriage until the Arizona Quints are born. Five children born to Nathan Arizona and his wife. And Ed gets it in her mind that, well, they've got too many of the kids.
Yeah.
Why don't we just take one and we'll raise it as our own?
Mm-hmm.
And poor High is trying to lead a life of normalcy and trying to get away from his crime days. But as their relationship really starts to hit some rocky ground, as Ed is going through this, he starts to think, you know, I would drive by convenience stores for no reason late at night and wonder. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he's got these urges that he wants to get back into his own old regular routine, but he's trying to do good. But he just can't. And so they go and they kidnap one of the Quints. I believe they kidnapped Nathan Jr. He's the good one. And then that leads into all sorts of troubles.
Right. Yeah, because once they have this kid, Matthew, they realize, well, now we have a kid. But some other people show up in High and Ed's little house that makes it a problem for them to continue leaving their somewhat wholesome lifestyle with this newly abducted child.
That is true. Nathan's former cellmates, Gail and Ethel, show up, and they have a plan that involves a man who can handle a gun.
Well, they don't just show up.
No, yeah, I was going to get to that.
They break out of prison.
Out of prison.
And the first place they go to.
Out of prison, in fact.
Well, that was the crazy thing. I was watching this movie, and I'm like, this is Shawshank Redemption, you know, busting out of the thing. And I was like, wait, this movie was made when? So I jump, I'm like, okay, 87. When was Shawshank? I'm pretty sure it was early 90s. It was like 5 years later. I'm like, John Goodman's character, he's even like down on his knees in the rain, covered in crap.
Right.
Like celebrating. I'm like, this is Shawshank. This is so weird.
Right. Yeah, it is interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, Matthew, so they have an interesting plan that they're going to make enough money that they can retire.
That's true. They're going to go and they're going to knock over I believe it's the Farmers and Mechanics Bank.
Yeah.
And they're going to enter into a long wave of crime across the whole Southwest, which reminded me of nothing so much as Babyface Nelson in that other Coen Brothers movie. But then they discover that maybe the baby isn't all that he seems as well.
Absolutely. Because Nathan Arizona, the rich man that he is offering a $25,000 reward for, is it just information or just return to the baby, essentially?
Return of the baby, no questions asked.
And so a lot of people put two and two together and realize that High and Ed have this kid, and one of their friends, his High's boss from work, figures it
Glenn.
Out. Glenn.
Who's a terrible, terrible human being.
Yeah, and you may not recognize his face, but you would certainly recognize his voice, Sam McMurray, who does a lot of voice work for The Simpsons.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so between... So Glenn actually says, you know what? I'm not going to turn you in if you give me the baby because my wife wants another kid.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the easiest way to do it. And so it's like, okay, they've got that going. They've got our good friends Glenn and Evel, who are wanting to rob stuff, and they basically are going to take the kid and turn it in for money.
Yep.
And then on top of that, you have a bounty hunter played by Randall Tex Cobb, Leonard Smalls, and again, people may recognize Randall Cobb as the goon in. The Eddie Murphy movie, not to slip my mind, The Golden Child. He plays one of the heavies for Notam
really?
Noomspa.
Yeah, he plays pretty much the goon in every movie he's in.
And so he kind of figures out where the kid is at, and he goes to Nathan Arizona and says, hey, I want this money, and I'll bring you back the kid.
Mm-hmm. But he's asking for double the money.
Yeah, he's asking for a lot more of the money.
Because people will pay that much to have a baby.
And I'll get the baby one way or the other, he says.
Yeah. And so this leads to a big heist and chase and all sorts of things. And in the process, High and Ed, have a falling out.
Where
Ed basically says, look, what we've done is wrong. I'm an officer of the law. I shouldn't have done this. And I don't love you anymore, High.
We're done.
Yeah, especially because they're in a tight situation, and High's like, because he loses his job,
right?
Because his friend boss. Glenn had the idea of, High's thinking, I'm going to be a dad now. Where's the excitement in all of this life? I was a criminal, and Glenn's like, hey, I think you think my wife's attractive, and I kind of think your wife's attractive. Well, maybe, we could just both be swingers together. And then High punches him square in the face.
Right.
Glenn fires him. And so they're out of this money. They don't have any, they have any money to come in. So High's like, well, I got to go back to what I know. I'm going to go rob a convenience store.
Yeah.
Which
I'll
let
take
in
these huggies and whatever cash you have in the cash register.
Which that's what set Ed off. And she pulls out with the baby, which then led to one of the best chase scenes I think we've watched in a movie in a while.
Yeah.
There's a couple of great chase scenes in this film, which I was not expecting, but they were at both times really well put together and exciting to watch, but also balanced the funny with it as well.
Yeah.
So it was great to see some of that in this.
Yeah.
But eventually they kind of get back together. They have the baby, but not for long, because then I believe his cellmates
take the baby. They take the baby because they're going to.
They take the baby.
Yeah, they take the baby from that.
Yeah.
And then we have a big kind of final showdown at the end of the film between those two and High and Ed and Smalls. And then.
So remember last week when we were talking about. When we were talking about the Hudsucker Proxy, and we said that there's this battle between good and evil in that film, Leonard Smalls represents the devil again, once again in this movie. I mean, he comes to High in a dream. He sees this thing escaping from hell and tracking him down. He has this premonition, and it plays out that Leonard is just he looks like a dirty, grubby biker. He wears grenades on his chest. He's got double-barreled shotguns. He's willing to take people out. He'll be driving down the highway and just throw a grenade at a rabbit and blow it up. I mean, this is not a nice guy. And he has, in this movie, of everyone, if you look at those alignment charts that you play in Dungeons & Dragons, sure. He is that chaotic evil character. Mm-hmm. He just is pure evil in this movie. And High is kind of, you know, I would say he's like... not lawful evil, Matthew, but, you know, he's
evil.
He's a bad guy, but not a bad, bad guy, because when he goes and robs, he never loads his gun up, because then it would be armed robbery as opposed to just robbery. Right, so, you know, he's thinking about this and he's trying to do better and he's trying to do good. But in the end, it has to be good versus evil in fighting this. And it has to be High standing up to everything that he would have been. He's got to turn his back on this finally, and he does when he blows up Leonard by yanking out one of the pins from the grenades, and he blows up, and then they say, you know what, the way we need to do this is we need to return this kid to Nathan, Arizona, and they do, and it has a resolution there. But I just think that it's amazing now that in two movies there is some personification of evil that is clearly displayed on the screen for the hero to battle out with in the end.
Well, I know I'm just Matthew mentioned Over the Where Art Thou without saying the name earlier, and that movie also has the literal devil in it. And so that Smalls character is really interesting, because as I was reflecting over the ending of this film right before we started, the movie ends after they give the baby, and High kind of goes into this dream state again that we got in the middle of the film when we are kind of introduced to the Smalls character, of him looking forward into the future and seeing all these kids and grandkids, and there's this couple, and he says it's him and Ed.
I don't think it says it's him and Ed, though.
But I think he thinks it's him
and Ed. It's implied
that
it's him and Ed, right?
And so that's what I'm thinking. What is the whole state of this film? Because he says he's prone to, you know, drift off from reality at times, and he literally did think there's no way he should know the Smalls character.
Right.
And then he has this dream, and then this Smalls character is in this world now. So it makes you wonder at what realm this film's kind of taking place, because is it in reality, or is it in High's head, or that's kind of where I was left thinking at the end of this film.
The ending is kind of weird, because we know that Ed can't have kids, but they've been told to sleep on it for a night. They're going to split up at the end of this movie, but Nathan Arizona says, no, you guys spend one more night together and then decide in the morning, right? And then he has this dream, and it gets really weird, because we know she can't have kids. And then he says something about going to Utah. So,
well, the last line is maybe it was Utah. He was dreaming about a place where good things can happen, and families are always good, and parents are always wise, and children are always healthy.
But so I'm wondering, though, is that an implication that he's just going to leave and go to Utah and start over without Ed?
No.
You don't think so?
I don't. And the reason why is one word, four syllables, and we see it, and we've never really talked about it in depth in any of the Coen Brothers films so far. And that word is surrealism.
Mm-hmm.
It's most, to me, I think, obvious in Barton Fink, which we haven't seen and probably won't.
No.
But every one of the Coen Brothers movies that we've seen have some element of surreality to them, where things are dreamlike.
Ludicrous. They come off as ludicrous in many instances. And by the way, before Matthew continues, Barton Fink has a little literal representation of the devil in It, too, played by John Goodman.
Oh,
it does.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things where you're just like, hey, these guys have themes.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the ending, I think you can read it either way, because we see that High demonstrably has the ability to divine truth at certain points in the film. High sees what is coming to destroy his family and tries to act on it. And High sees when he's doing, you know, in a less overt fashion, when he's doing what he's doing, he realizes that he's doing wrong. He realizes he's in trouble and that bad things are going to happen. But he really can't help himself from holding up the convenience store anyway. And I think that ending is one of those things where we can look at it and say, well, I prefer to believe that that's an example of him seeing something that can be and should be and will be for him and Ed.
Yeah, a happy ending.
Well, not necessarily a happy ending, but at least an ending that has some positive elements to it. And it gives you that O. Henry, Rod Serling moment where you can go, I approve of this ending. Or you can look at it as just a big setup for that final joke, which is probably the funniest joke in the whole movie for me. Maybe it was Utah.
Yeah.
But I think that when you really break it down, when you have, you know, the literal embodiment of the devil riding around on a Honda motorcycle, and you have the moments in this film where get down and freeze. Well, which is it?
To get down or freeze? No, I think that's part of the thing that I like about the Coen brothers, especially when they do their comedies, is that there is a wonderful play on words where, you know, one person will say something and it's like, well, what meaning are you saying on this? Do you mean this or do you mean that?
Mm-hmm.
I think Matthew runs into that a lot on the internet with his internet troll followers, where he'll say something and then everyone will just pile on with, oh, did you mean this? Or did you mean this? Or did you mean this? And then Matthew gets super frustrated, just like John Goodman gets frustrated in this movie. So
say my troll friends,
no, I didn't say troll friends. I said your internet trolls,
my internet trolls, Steven. Who is their leader, Stephen?
Not me. I think it's your friend Carl is the one that usually instigates it.
It's definitely Carl.
Yeah, I think he's the one that usually instigates it.
Yeah, of course.
I think there is that in there that makes the movies funny, especially when you look at Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where you've got George Clooney, who is trying to use large words to make himself sound smart. He doesn't always use them correctly, and then it becomes even more funny. Because people are taking a different interpretation of what he's saying. So they are very good at their wordplay in their films.
There are a lot of parallels between this movie and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And I think the major difference for me, aside from the fact that, you know, Oh Brother is really kind of a period piece, but the similarities kind of break down to a point where we, the audience, don't necessarily take High seriously. We don't look at Nicolas Cage and think this is a character that we take seriously as either a criminal threat or as, you know, a good father or whatever you look at, but you can't help but feel for him.
Well, this is what we said last week with Hudsucker Proxy, where the Coens like to, in their comedies, use the fool as their hero because the audience will sympathize with them a lot more. So High is the fool. The Hudsucker Proxy, a Tim Robbins character, is the fool. George Clooney is the fool in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And they do that again and again and again.
They have a trifurcated fool in that Everett and Pete and Delmer are all basically different facets of a fool.
Right.
Kind of triumvirate.
Right. But you're right in that they have this foolish character. That's why we can sympathize with them more.
And I want to go back. I read a review from Roger Ebert, as I'm wont to do before with films when we're looking a while ago. And he reviewed the film back when it came out in 87. And, you know, this is a film that has a very high Rotten Tomato rating. Those with an aggregate of review scores. So I was expecting high remarks from Mr. Ebert, but not so. It was like a 1.5 out of 4 stars. And he did not really like this movie. And I think it kind of hits on what
did
we're talking
why?
About.
What were the
yeah, well, the one of the ones, if what we're kind of hitting on is this surrealism where one of his complaints was it couldn't decide if it was reality or this kind of extra reality type situation we were playing with. And he didn't really like that. And he also, he said he really hated the accents, essentially. What do you want to boil it down
and
to?
And again,
it?
That's another thing that you look at the Coens comedies, especially. They like to, and I don't want to say make fun of dialect, but they like to take dialect and stretch it out
and
to
push
its extreme.
It. Yeah.
And they use that dialect as a tool, and sometimes it's a blunt instrument. Here, it's very much a blunt instrument, especially with Nicolas Cage hitting you over the head with the fact that the dialect means that this is a person who is not particularly bright.
Well, even in Big Lebowski, the Jesus is the same way, where that accent, the dialect, is really pushed to the extreme.
That's a huge example.
And you know, it was interesting because I was watching this film, and Aubrey came in. I actually think Ed was talking, and she goes, "Why are they talking like that?" it doesn't matter. Just go away.
Roll with it.
But yeah, it is interesting. The more I've watched their films, how they do use accents in a way that it's like you're saying, it's a push of the accent to a point where you have to accept it, and it does kind of push it into that absurdist reality that they're doing these films in, because you look at Fargo and they're kind of pushed, and then Burton or Hudsucker Proxy, not so much accents there, but in the cadence of speech that in the decade they were going with the reporter and then the head editor of the newspaper, where they were just talking super fast and really staccato and everything. It was just crazy. And then you get into Raising Arizona, where everything is, I don't even know what to describe it as.
Southwest.
Well, is that what it is? It's not Southwest.
Southwest Hillbilly.
That is Alabama and North Carolina in many of these voices. It is not necessarily as something you'd hear in the Southwest. As a man who married a woman who grew up there, these are not things that you hear. But the thing about it is those accents, as they sound here, are, I don't even know how to describe it. It's that thing where someone speaks in that manner, and your brain remembers all the people who speak in that manner. And you remember Goober from the Andy Griffith Show, and you remember Huckleberry Hound. And it's so iconic of an accent, it kind of helps to build the character without actually building the character. It becomes part of what you know about them. So knowing that it's not really a realistic accent is not the point of, you know, hearing them talk, especially Holly Hunter, who I don't know what it is about Holly Hunter in this movie, but she's just adorable.
Oh, she is in all of her movies. And she does have a bit of an accent in her speech anyway. So
yeah, because she,
and so does
it
Nicolas
sounds
Cage.
Like, yeah.
I mean, neither one of them are pushing it too far past where they're at.
Yeah.
But
I've never heard Holly Hunter talk outside of a film, but thinking of her character in Our Brother, Where Art Thou, she does have that kind of twang in her voice. It's just not to the extreme that it is in Raising Arizona.
She's from Georgia, and her natural speaking voice does have that Georgia drawl, not like really, really drawly, but it's definitely there in anything she says. You can hear it in Andy McDowell's voice, too. You have that Southern accent at play. And sometimes getting away from it is harder than, you know, building the character on it.
Another thing that we've seen now in these Coen Brothers films is an overall narration to it, which in Raising Arizona, we start out with, the intro of, you know, 5-10 minutes, where most of it is just 15 straight
minutes of narration.
You have narration of setting up the story.
Right.
How do you think it was used in this film compared to the other ones? Because I think, Matthew, you might have had some complaints about narration. I can't remember if it was you or Rodrigo last week.
I think we both voiced issues about the narration in Hudsucker. The narration here is a little bit of a different matter, because it's well, I don't want to say first person, but it's one of the characters in the film telling us of what happened to him to bring him to this point. And even though it's not necessarily told in the past tense, it's as though he's an omniscient narrator of his own life. I can kind of accept that a little bit more than having like the voiceover of Sam Elliott, as wonderful as it is in, in Lebowski, where that character seems to be aware of what's going to happen. That character is like omniscient, as though he were writing the story. Whereas here it feels more like Hai telling us, these are the things that happened to me and brung me to where I am, and her insides are a rocky place where my seed cannot, you know, just so lyrical.
And well, that's the other thing that's nice about these is when we look at George Clooney's character in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, he uses the big words and he comes off like a fool. Here, Hai uses the words and it's like, wow, this person is really eloquent in what he's thinking inside of his mind.
Right.
Yet when he speaks, he's not right. And I find that also an additional layer of hysterics, which tells us a little bit more about the character, right? Because if you're telling your story, you want to come off as the brilliant person, right? And I wonder, because we're getting his story, telling the audience, here's what happened, if he's not using that as an embellishment to make himself better than everyone else.
To some degree, but I think there's also the thing of when you look at a character like Hai, he is rough-edged, but he has a weird wisdom about him, and he has an intellect that you can definitely see in the things that he does. He's as dumb as a bag of hammers, but he has an understanding of certain things, and he has a level of wisdom, if not sophistication, in the way that he deals with the things around him. And some of it, I think, falls down to that, you know, that the homespun, well, old Brer Rabbit knew he had himself a hard time. But it's also something where it works for me because it's high in his head. And the voice in your head, you know, we mentioned this briefly. When I listen to myself on the show, I don't sound the way I do in my head. It's kind of like that thing where Ted Mosby sounded like Bob Saget for 9 seasons, because what we're hearing is the narration in his head, and he's got time to think through it and make it sound really good and awesome. But when he's speaking in real life, it becomes clear that he's not an extemporaneous speaker. And also, you know, we see a little bit of maybe supernatural ability that he has. So we're definitely not looking as just your garden variety yokel when it comes to HI.
Now, Stephen, last week you mentioned in Raising Arizona features one of your, was it favorite songs? Favorite songs, period.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite songs. That's the Way Out There song. And then it's expanded upon in the big chase sequence where he robs the store and then they're on the run. It's really interesting because here's the thing. I think the music is good. It is scored by Carter Burwell. And so if you go to his website and he talks about this, he was like, oh, I had no idea what I was doing. I just sat down with a banjo and this guy who yodeled and we just kind of knocked this out, right?
Yeah.
Implying in the way he's telling it is that this is my all original work. If you go onto the Wikipedia, it says themes are borrowed from Goofing Off Suite by Pete Seeger in 1955. That's great. But if you go back to like 1922 or something like that, maybe even earlier, there's a Western band called Sons of the Pioneers, and they have a song called Way Out There, which you listen to it and it is the opening half. The first half of their song is is this main title sequence that they have in here. And I've never seen anyone say, oh, this is Sons of the Pioneers.
Really?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You can go. I'll put a link in the show notes, or I'll actually embed the YouTube video. But you can find Sons of the Pioneer.
Okay.
And Way Out There, and you will be able to hear the song and say, "Oh yeah, that's exactly what this is." So either Pete Seeger is also borrowing bits and pieces from this, but you know, if you listen to that song, and it's wonderful. I'm not trying to tear anyone down. I'm just trying to find out where is the actual source of this song. Because it's not what everyone says it is. I mean, there's truths and half-truths that are out there.
It's folk music, too. I mean, folk music has a tendency to be, you know, kind of the equivalent of a story told 100 times. You hear Holly Hunter actually sings an old folk song to the baby in this movie. You hear variations and takes on those things and different lyrics to the exact same song or the same song with an entirely different ending because those songs evolve and they change as they go. So I wouldn't be surprised if you trace it back to 1933 and find that the Sons of the Pioneers got it from a group in 1874.
But they may have. I mean, the interesting thing about Sons of the Pioneers was that Roy Rogers was a member of that group before he went on to go do his thing. But I don't know. You guys may be able to hear it here, but like I said, I'll embed it. Give it a second here, and then I'll.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, that is, that's it. That's the song.
Yep. And then it goes into the song. So I don't know if yodeling cowboy stuff, and really when it comes to Western music, I like yodeling cowboy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's the weird part. I hate most other Western country and Western music, but yodeling cowboy stuff I really get a kick out of. But I have not done enough research into the yodeling cowboy subgenre mm-hmm. to find out if that is a very typical intro that you would
something
find.
Else.
I'm going to say yodeling cowboy.
Yeah. Well, there's a point where part of the Pete Seeger song that shows up that goes, da, da, mm-hmm. da, da. Yeah. I've heard that like 100 times. And there's there's a point on one of the Monkees albums where Peter Tork, of all people, starts whistling it and playing the banjo. And I have that chunk of song that sticks in my head literally for months and months at a time. So thanks, Zach.
Welcome.
I'm going to be whistling that until at least Halloween.
Oh no, I love that song. I when I jog or when I'm walking or riding my bike, I'll often have that run through my head.
Well, I don't walk or ride anything.
Well, maybe you should. They also include, you know, there's bits of Beethoven in there. Russian folk music is in there too. It's a nice mix in how it's mixed together. And again, I'm not trying to downgrade anything that Carter Burwell or Pete Seeger or whoever. Beethoven, you know, put all this together because in the way that it's mixed, and today we would call this what a mashup or something, right?
Mm-hmm. They're just sampling.
Yeah, sampling or a mashup or, you know, throwing all these things together. It works really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates one of the most memorable moments in the movie is this big chase from the time he walks into the store to rob it to the point where they go and get Huggies and conclude the chase some 5-6 minutes later.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That chase scene has to be kind of the best bit of this film for me in that it typifies just kind of this crazy, over-the-top chase scene, and it includes this great soundtrack, and it's funny, and then it has cinematography that I was really impressed with in this film, because you're looking in not that they ever have bad cinematography in the Coen Brothers films, but there are some shots in this 1987 film that, you know, you would not be surprised at seeing in a 2016 action film where they are, mm-hmm. you know, they are putting a camera right on the tire wheel, essentially this wide shot, and it's right there. And that's an easy shot to do now with a GoPro or a DSLR camera or a tiny little, a film camera, it might not be hard, but back then you're running these huge film cameras. That's not a easy shot to get.
Okay, so let's talk about the evolution of that of one shot, especially the one where he's having the dream about busting into the Arizona household and taking the kid, right?
Yeah.
So this floating camera thing, a lot of ways you can do that. Steadicam is probably the easiest way to do it, or to, you know, rig it like this.
Oh, you're talking about that shot.
Yeah, or even the shot on the tire stuff.
Yeah.
When you look at evolution of Coen Brothers, what movie did we see Hudsucker Proxy last week? Yeah. Who was the co-writer of that film?
It was what's his face?
Bob Hudsucker.
No, it was
Sam Raimi, right?
Yes.
Sam Raimi did what famous film, Zach?
The Chainsaw Spider-Man. Guy. Or just Spider-Man.
Evil Dead.
Evil Dead, yeah.
No, come on, Spider-Man. Evil Dead.
Yeah.
Spider-Man.
Yeah, sure, I know he did, but if we're talking about famous films, let's talk about Evil Dead. In Evil Dead, and you're looking at
people who
are doing
woods.
Low budget productions. He talks about this is their cheap Steadicam was they would take their camera, strip it down to its bare minimum, connect it to a 2x4, mm-hmm. two people would grab it, and then they just walk and do this really cool whippy swoopy move. So when we look at the fact that the Coens and Raimis are connected, Barry Sonnenfeld, who would go on to direct Get Shorty and Men in Black, is the cinematographer mm-hmm. on Raising Arizona, you can still see the mentality of low budget filmmaking in this and coming up with unique angles. Mm-hmm. And they probably didn't have a giant rig to mount on the car to get those, to get a lot of those shots. Oh, so they're using their ingenuity and creativity. And I think a lot of that comes from this communication between small indie filmmakers doing this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I think if you wanted to look at that and say, oh, this is really cool. Well, look at who they're connected with and who they're talking with. And let's see how ideas are being passed from one person to another to evolve this film narrative that we have mm-hmm. in visual storytelling.
Yeah, I couldn't find in a quick search for the budget for Raising
Arizona.
It says
$6 million for the budget. It was shot in 10 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's really long.
But it made $30 million at the box office.
Yeah, so it's pretty good.
It's pretty good. I mean, it's a hit.
Yeah. And so that's what I was wondering with, because when you look at that shot of him going to the yard mm-hmm. into the Arizona house, there's another one of him standing at the curb out in front of the convenience store after Ed drives away.
Right.
Where there is like this, I mean, it's a push into it. It's mm-hmm. a dolly, but you would think mm-hmm. it was a steady cam shot, but it does get a little wonky at the end. So you're either like a bad steady cam operator or they couldn't afford to have a steady cam,
right.
which was my thought. Like, this is a pretty low budget movie.
Right.
You know, they're not showing a lot of money into this. So they probably had some rigged type of system they were doing, especially with the shot of the lawn, because that camera goes straight over like a fountain or something. Mm-hmm. So they would have had to have
a
rig of two people.
It would have been a 2x4
yeah.
kind of setup, just like you'd see in Evil Dead. Now, I'm seeing, I'm guessing if you have the DVD of this, there may be a making of attached to it.
I
didn't look to see if the iTunes versions had any. I don't think it had anything.
Oh, I just
like
rented
that.
It, so I didn't see.
Well, I didn't see anything when I was watching it the other night. I don't remember seeing any making of, because I really kind of had some time to watch that. But apparently in the making of, they talk a little bit more about the development of some of these shots.
Yeah, because that was, I mean, they're like those camera attached to tire type shots.
Mm-hmm.
It straight into mind is Christopher Nolan uses shots like that all the time. There's the one that always sticks in my mind. Obviously, he didn't direct Batman. What's the Batman, Man of Steel, the one that everyone hates? Is that what it was, Man of Steel?
Batman v Superman.
No, the one before that.
Oh, Man of Steel.
Oh, Man of Steel.
That's
Zack Snyder, but Christopher Nolan was executive mm-hmm. Producer on mm-hmm. that. And there's definitely some shots in that, like, oh, this is Nolan. This is the shot where the camera's like attached to the bus as it's falling off the bridge. Like, that is like a Nolan type shot. I think he does some stuff like that in Inception. Mm-hmm. And so I was very surprised to see this, you know, two decades or more earlier in Raising Arizona, to see some of this cinematography was really great. Did you have anything particularly you thought was well done, Matthew, when it comes to cinematography?
I think the part that really sticks out to me is when Smalls arrives in the little town and Holly Hunter grabs the baby and starts running. And we get a point of view shot chasing her, and then we cut back to him with his bike. So she runs into the bank, and then we cut to him smashing through the doors.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see her run across the floor, and we see him smash through another door. I really like the fact that she's constantly in motion, and you never see him in her shot.
Right.
But as soon as they cut, he's right there on top of her.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels really claustrophobic and awful, and it feels like he's somehow supernatural in his pursuit of her, because she's running, he's clearly not there, and when she turns around, he is right on top of her.
Yeah, just like the devil.
Like the devil. Devil's gonna get you. Or a vampire.
You know, back to the devil thing, it is interesting. In Hudsucker Proxy, we really had, you know, Hudsucker came down as this angel. I guess he didn't really fight the devil. It was the clock man and the window guy.
Mm-hmm.
Because in this, it definitely feels like, I think you mentioned this, Matthew, is not, or Steven, is not this like ultimate good.
And
it doesn't really feel like there is this ultimate good in Raising Arizona.
If you had to say there was an ultimate good, it would probably be Nathan Arizona's wife.
Okay.
because, I mean, she's in the film so little, but I mean, here she is giving birth to the kids. She says, you got this motherly figure thing. She comes off as very conservative and nice and loving or whatever. Mm-hmm. So she might be the ultimate good in the movie, contrasted with Smalls, who's the ultimate evil in the movie.
Sure.
I think the lack of a clear counterpart for the literal devil is one of the weaknesses of the film, because even if you know, if you look at it as Mrs. Arizona, or if you look at it as maybe Ed as a counterbalancing positive force, Mrs. Arizona is really barely in the movie.
Right.
And Ed makes a lot of decisions that are somewhat questionable from a level of morality.
Right. Well, and so then in that case, High is our hero in this case. And since he's the one that fights the devil at the end, he's battling literally his own personal demons.
Well, yeah.
Right.
And he, there's a point where he discovers that they have the same tattoo,
which was odd.
Because
it's not like it was exactly him, because it was a different location, right? His was up on, like, Small's up on his collarbone.
Yeah, but I mean, it's still the fact
it's
the same.
Yeah. Which again led to this whole weird thing.
Yeah. Well, are they brothers or are they prison brothers, right? Is this one of the things that. And Leonard Smalls, being the bounty hunter, probably would not have been a prisoner, but it's one of these things where it's the final reaction for High to say, is this a path I'm going down? Mm. Is this the moment where I go ahead and continue to be evil and go to jail and do these bad, horrible things? Or is this the moment where I'm going to change my life? And fortunately, he pulls the grenade probably unintentionally. But shows that good can win if he wants to walk that straight and narrow, which then is followed through in his dream sequence where he's having this very peaceful, happy life surrounded by people that love him.
Well, especially
for ultimate evil is actually High's potential for good.
Or the fact that he makes that decision to go down the road of good.
Mm-hmm. Especially because after that, they do give back the baby, knowing about the reward, I do believe.
Well, they didn't know about the reward, because Nathan comes in and says, do you guys want the reward? And they're like, what reward?
Well, because did they agree to it at first? And then it's like, oh, no, we don't want the reward. Or
they were just like, look,
like, we don't want it.
He's trying to negotiate. We can give you store credit. I prefer it.
Yeah.
Which I thought that was one of my favorite jokes in the film, where he's selling unpainted furniture.
So that's actually a big deal. I mean, a big thing. I mean,
I've never heard about it.
Well, it's probably not a big thing now because there's so much cheaper furniture that you can buy completed. But, growing up, if you wanted to get some really nice furniture, like oak table, dining table, hutches, those kinds of things, for me, there was a place in Kansas City called the Unvarnished Truth. And it was this place. It was, you go in and they had all the furniture that you wanted, all the hardwood furniture, but it wasn't finished because that's how they could give it to you at a cheaper price. You were then responsible for going and staining it the color you wanted,
you turn it whatever color.
And so a lot of the furniture in my house growing up was from Unvarnished Truth. Mom's just really good at finishing things off. And would go to town on that stuff. So
that was a real thing?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I thought it was just a joke, and I thought it was hilarious.
No. I mean, I think it is a joke, but it's an actual real thing. I mean, I think they're using it as a joke.
It's a reference for sure.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I never knew anything like that existed.
Yeah, there you
go. That's so cool.
Well, it was the 80s. Things were different then.
Well, in the 70s, too.
It can fly now.
It might. I don't know, but because, you go and... probably the closest thing would be IKEA, right? Where
you go
and you buy all the parts for the furniture that you want to make, and then you assemble it. Like this desk right here is a kitchen countertop and some legs.
Oh, is that
IKEA.
What it is?
Yeah, it's a kitchen countertop and legs from IKEA. I could get 15 different kinds of legs from IKEA if I wanted to, but I can assemble it myself, right? And so, I think you have a lot of those kind of things here. But the fact that you're using MDF today brought the cost down tremendously to where stores like Unvarnished Truth, well, why do we need a nice big oak dining table when we can just go to, Schlock and Co. and buy a little MDF thing that we'll use for 10 years and then buy a new one?
Mm-hmm. Well, learn something new.
There you go.
That's great.
There you go.
Let's see what else did I have written down for Raising Arizona. I don't know when Nicolas Cage started, but this has to be pretty early in his career, right?
Nicolas Cage was in Valley Girl in 1982.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So this is maybe 4 or 5 years
in. And I want to say that Moonstruck came out in 87 as well.
Yeah, this is the same year as Moonstruck, and I think the same year as Peggy Sue Got Married. Because he'd been in a couple of movies. I believe his first movie was Valley Girl.
Best of Times was his first movie.
Oh, I never heard
Nicholas
of that.
Coppola. Then he was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. He was one of the guys that takes off his shirt in the restaurant when they're going in.
Oh, okay.
Hey, man. He's one of the stoners.
Little Nicky Coppola.
Then he was in Valley Girl, Rumblefish, Racing with the Moon, The Cotton Club, Birdie, The Boy in Blue, Peggy Sue Got Married, Raising Arizona, and Moonstruck.
Oh, my gosh.
Peggy Sue Got Married came out in 86. So.
Yeah. Well, that's close.
Yeah.
And did he ever do a Coen Brothers film again, or was this his only one?
They had a lot of difficulty on set because
I was wondering if that was a thing.
According to reports, Nicolas Cage would come to the set and have suggestions on things, and the Coen Brothers would completely ignore him. And then later in interviews, he'd say, "Well, they're very set in this vision that they have."
Mm-hmm.
That he would say in interviews. So I don't know if he's worked on any other Coen Brother movies, but I would guess, considering his most recent run of things, probably not.
Yeah.
Wasn't Nicholas like, he's like a heavy duty method actor though, isn't he?
I don't know.
Oh, I don't know about Cage.
I mean, you know,
I thought he was one of those guys who would assume himself in the role to the point where he would only answer to, or maybe I'm thinking of Johnny Depp.
You may be thinking of someone else. Cause I don't think that is Nicholas Cage.
Mm. Man, I wish it was, though. That'd be weird.
Well, it would certainly explain The Wicker Man.
It is interesting when you find these directors who like to work over and over again with these actors, and you feel like, well, that's a pretty famous actor. I don't think they ever worked again together. Like, something had to go wrong there.
Yeah. So, they did not work together. I'm looking through Nicolas Cage's stuff. No, they did not work together.
But if you look at the movies that Cage chooses to be in, you can kind of see why he doesn't necessarily mesh with the Coens, because if you look at the actors that work with them repeatedly, if you look at, you know, like your Francis McDormand and you look at your John Goodman, these are actors who, when you see them in a role, you don't necessarily think of them as like the wild card, the unpredictable character. And even when you have a character who's meant to be unpredictable in these movies, it feels very controlled. It feels like the director's really got a hand on what's going on. This doesn't feel like one of those, you know, Will Ferrell joints where everybody's improvising to the point where they have a different movie if they assemble different takes, you know?
Right.
I wonder if it's just one of those things where his style doesn't mesh with the Coens directing.
That's possible. Not. I was, you know, John Goodman pops up in this and I thought, you know, if we can nominate a fifth person or the fifth, I'm going to sound stupid if that's not right, another head on Mount Rushmore, right? Like a popular vote. I feel like John Goodman deserves, if not like a head on Mount Rushmore, like five stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame or something, because I love
him. The man's amazing.
He is so good.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what was interesting is we're watching this and Aubrey's there and John Goodman shows up and she goes, oh, hey, it's that guy from Red State.
Yeah.
Which I think there's a few other movies she's seen John Goodman in, but that's interesting. That was the first one that came to her mind. That's
well, and the funny. Weird thing about John Goodman is he's a very, very specific presence, but he's such a chameleon in weird ways where you're always like, oh my God, it's John Goodman. And then you see him just acting in a completely different manner. What was that Cloverfield movie? 10 Cloverfield Lane. He is in that. I'm not going to spoil it because that's a good one.
Yeah.
But throughout that movie, there is nothing in his performance that you can predict.
Mm.
And his character, when you start to see what's going on and you're like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And then it turns out it's not what it is. And then it turns out, oh my God, it's something. But throughout the whole thing, he is rock solid in his interpretation of this character.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so subtle that the changes and a little bit of that is visible here, but you see it better in other Coen movies. The changes in his interaction with the stuff can change the whole movie.
Continue.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, is John Goodman in next week's film, No Country for Old Men?
No, I don't believe he is. No.
Sad day.
No. His most recent Coen Brothers collab was Inside Llewelyn Davis.
I still haven't seen that.
Yeah. And then I was going back to see what all of the movies he has been in with Coens. And so before that, it may have been Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? May have been the one.
Oh,
so
really?
He had like a 3-year gap or 12-year gap. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
He was in Barton Fink. He was in Lebowski. He was in
this.
Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Mm-hmm.
He was in the Flintstones.
He was in
the Flintstones. What's the Flintstones say?
No.
Hudsucker Proxy. What was he in that? He was in it briefly, I guess.
He was the newsreel announcer.
Yeah.
Yes. That's what it was.
Yeah. So next week we are. Oh, guess any final thoughts on
this? Is
Raising Arizona?
This is a good, fun movie, and I think it would have been interesting if Rodrigo could have been here tonight, because it'd be interesting to see a take on this movie from two people who have no kids,
yeah, right,
that you know of, and then two people that have kids, because
that we know of.
This is a different. To me, this is a different film,
mm-hmm,
when you view this after having kids.
Oh, okay.
Or going through an adoption process or whatever. Because I think there is this thing that you can really empathize with what is going on with Ed in this piece. And really kind of getting into the mindset of where she's coming from. And this desire to have a family from both High and Ed that I think is different for people who have had kids, as opposed to people who are like, they want kids. Why? I'm 25. I want to go smoke my cigarettes and grow my beard kind of thing stuff. Whatever.
Grow my cigarettes.
That's what I do.
Yeah. So I think that would be an interesting perspective on the different sides.
Mm, interesting. Matthew, you have any thoughts on Raising Arizona as we finish up?
I don't know. And it, you know, we all take different things away from the movie. I didn't feel anything parentally because the movie is cartoonish enough that I never really thought of Nathan as a real baby. You know, it throughout this movie, the baby never cries and he never gets upset. And there's
that's
because
he's the good one.
There's that sequence that should be horrifying where Gail and Llewellyn are driving at him and stopping on a dime. And I'm just like, oh, that's terrible. You know, I didn't necessarily feel like that was something that stuck out to me. But the one thing about this movie that is great and terrible at the same time is this is early enough in their career that they still haven't necessarily learned where the line is. Because later Coen Brothers movies, you get a much more assured take on what is and isn't perfectly set up in their film. You know, we talk about Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? We talk about Lebowski, which is just a couple of years later. This movie feels like it's kind of out of control, but it's out of control in like a party at, you know, Leroy's house in 1992 kind of way, where you almost feel like that out of control is part of the draw of this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there, you know, we talked about the weird non-sequiturs that happened every once in a while, mm-hmm, in Hudsucker Proxy, which, mm-hmm, threw me for a loop and kind of put this crazy spin on that film. There wasn't any of that in this, which to me, it felt more controlled than Hudsucker, where they were just kind of just putting stuff in there for laughs and giggles.
And considering that Hudsucker came after this,
yeah,
and this one had such a high profit margin,
yeah,
as far as the money made, that they, mm-hmm, may have been just given free rein to do whatever they want, and
sure,
that's what caused Hudsucker Proxy to actually lose a crap ton of money.
Yeah,
I mean,
it
was a huge money loss.
Yeah.
For the
Go
the
be
studios.
Wacky. You guys made that wacky movie, right?
Yeah. And so this film is crazy. I mean, there is a, I don't know, 2 or 3 minute sequence of a man pulling himself out of crap and mud, and then, mm-hmm, and then deciding he's going to go back into that at the end of this film, and just, you know, just wackadoo stuff like that. But it all felt in sequence. It set itself up as crazy from the moment a man in prison fell in love with the woman taking his photo. I'm going to assume he only saw her about four times in his life, which was great. And so it set it up that moment from the very beginning. And so to me, it felt the craziness had a purpose, and it wasn't like just, well, we're going to show a man getting his pants hemmed, mm-hmm, for 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I really enjoyed Raising Arizona. I enjoyed it more than Hudsucker Proxy.
Yeah, and I think most people, I mean, if you were to compare those two, I think most people would say this is a better movie than Hudsucker Proxy.
But I don't think it's better. Did you enjoy this more than Hail Caesar?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so too. Hail Caesar was
But if you ask me,
it's so different. I think I'd want to watch Hail Caesar again, though.
So, do you like this movie better than Big Lebowski?
No.
Yeah. So I think Lebowski is really high up there, and so is Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
You know, and Oh Brother, We're Out There. That would probably be my top three. You know, Coen Brothers movies.
Yeah.
But they're all the comedies, right? Mm-hmm. I think we've already seen Fargo, which is.
It's comedy-ish.
Yeah, it's some satire.
But it's serious.
It's a thriller, right?
Yeah.
And next week with No Country for Old Men, that's also another one that's thriller, that's dark, mm-hmm. right? So the Coens can either do really, really funny, or they can do really, really dark, like Blood Simple, No Country for Old Men, Fargo. And I think you're going to be kind of surprised with No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about this film we're talking about next week.
Mm-hmm.
And
same with Miller's Crossing, the same way.
Okay. What was the first one? Blood Simple?
Blood Simple.
That was their
first
film,
movie,
right? Yeah, I heard that one was kind of intense.
Yeah. And I would say, I would argue, Matthew, that even Barton Fink is also a dark. I don't find it very funny. It's just dark and disturbing.
Ew. Barton Fink is definitely one of the least comedic of their films.
Yeah, it's like dark and disturbing in a weird way. Like literally head in a box.
Yeah.
Kind of story.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
It's like Delve into the Darkness kind of movie.
And that's why, again, I'm interested and I haven't seen Inside Llewyn Davis yet, because it doesn't look like a comedy.
No.
But it doesn't look violent.
No, I think it's like a
music
film, right? Yeah. It's a
mockumentary. So I'm weirdly interested about that one, too. Yeah. So next week, we're talking No Country for Old Men,
yep.
which I've heard there's a disturbing. This man uses like an air-powered rifle or something.
Violence and mayhem ensue after a hunter stumbles upon a drug deal gone wrong and more than $2 million in cash near the Rio Grande.
Oh, there you go.
No Country for Old Men, 2007, directed by Ethan and Joel Cohen, written by Joel Cohen and Ethan and Tommy Lee Jones.
Tommy Lee Jones, that's
Josh Brolin, Javier Bardem.
Yeah.
It's going to be good times.
It's going to be good times. We're going to end up going to the film.
Wrapping
it up.
Yeah.
And then we'll start a whole new something in August. It'll be great.
We'll see.
Yeah. So that's it for this week's episode of Zach on Film. Thanks for being here, guys. While you're waiting for next week's episode to come out, head over to MajorSpoilers.com. It's Comic-Con week.
Yeah.
There's going to be just an absurd amount of news and trailers and all sorts of good stuff. So you're going to want to keep your eye on, you know, the Twitter feed of Major Spoilers, Facebook, and just the site in general to get all of that good news that Steven reports on it in the best way possible, right from his own basement. It'll be great. while you're on that site, click on the Amazon.com link, because there's going to be movies announced. You're probably going to start pre-ordering. Mm-hmm. Video games announced. You're going to start pre-ordering.
Oh,
just merch and everything.
Including the just announced Smash Up for PC, Mac, and iOS games. So.
Oh, okay. Sweet. You can get that pre-order at Amazon.com. Mm-hmm. But use that link at Major Spoilers. When you do that, a little bit of that money won't go to Amazon's pockets, but it will come back to Major Spoilers so they can keep creating great content for you every day of the week, all year long. We really appreciate it when you guys use that link. But that's it for this week's episode of Zach on Film. We'll see you next week.
This podcast is copyright 2016 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.